mean,
we are.
Great. You can, there's many new seats in here.
I think we are.
And.
I don't want to startle you. Are you guys okay?
I wish that I had.
We will begin. See how few people we have in the audience. All we have to do is put that sign up on the door. First of all, I apologize to the committee for the confusion, but we were having the executive committee, We were having the executive session in private Monday on the Cleary bill, not today. What we are doing is hearing HB 331 first, and that happens to be a bill that is sponsored by Representative Toohey, who happens to be here, and we would just welcome her to come up and tell us about this bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I apologize for my backup. Participants were here and left, and that was Jan Hansen of the HESS Division, Department of Public Assistance, as well as another gentleman from, anyway, he's not here.
We noticed.
And you will come up there.
Is it Tom Williams by chance?
I beg your pardon?
It wasn't Tom Williams.
No. Anyway, I do appreciate your hearing this bill. This is a bill that speaks about relating claims on permanent fund dividends for defaulting of public assistance overpayment. This bill will give the Department of Health and Social Services the authority to collect delinquent public assistance overpayments by administrative garnishment of an individual's permanent fund dividend. Currently, there are outstanding delinquent debts in excess of $1 million. Frequently, persons receiving overpayments agree to repay the debt, but despite repeated requests for payment, the debt is often ignored. House Bill 331 will enable the department to recover overpayments by a less expensive, more expedient administrative procedure. Recovery of debt would be pursued, in the same manner that delinquent student loans are pursued. This bill is supported by the Department of Health and Social Services, by the Department of Revenue. There are two positive revenue-generating fiscal notes from the Department of Health and Social Services, and a zero fiscal note from the Department of Revenue. And I urge your support. I would be happy to answer any questions. Jan Hansen from the Division of Public Assistance is not here, but she will be here shortly if she's needed. And Mike McGee from the Department of Revenue also available to speak shortly. So if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Are there any questions of the sponsor? Representative Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Toohey, are there any other conflicting statutes or requirements under public assistance or under especially the child, child protection services that would disallow this from happening? We'll let you take your coat off.
She's over here.
Have we got a mix up here?
I'm sorry, I only heard the
What I was wondering, is there any other restrictions, maybe through child protection services or through any other agency, that would prohibit this action from occurring?
Mr. Chairman, in terms of garnishing the permanent fund for our collection, there are other collections that go ahead of us. In statute, there are priorities, and we have not asked, or this bill, excuse me, doesn't ask for priority. Mm-hmm. So those that are in law for priority, which does include post-secondary education and child support,
right,
would go ahead, and then we would, public assistance would be down with any other one who had a right to garnish.
Okay.
Okay. Representative Davidson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Toohey, does this also apply when the overpayment is a result of bureaucratic or administrative error?
Yes. Would you like to answer that, Jen?
Mr. Chairman, let me clarify here that it does for the AFDC program, but not for the food stamp program, unless the client, there's a different regulation, and for food stamps, we can request repayment if the agency has made an error, but we can't require it. So we would not be garnishing for food stamp overpayments that were agency result. In the AFDC program, we're required to pursue claims whether it was the agency or the client. So for AFDC claims, this would be for both what the client did and what the agency did.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would just add for the record that because we're dealing with people who are right on the cutting edge of probably in most instances poverty or people with the least, we know that when they get an extra amount that it's probably going to be spent one way or another. So I think that's a little bit unfair. My other question, if I may ask, Does this mean then that children who are on AFDC, their dividends would also be taken because of such an administrative error?
Mr. Chairman, no, this doesn't apply to anyone who's on AFDC. This would only be for the repayment of claims of people whose cases are now closed. If they're still on, then we do a reduction in their benefit, and we don't...
Oh, I see. So you...
This is only... We try to collect on claims for cases, and if it's an open case, we set up an automatic recoupment. Unless the person... If the person pays us a check, that's fine. They have an option of paying us back, or we do an automatic 10% deduction of their ongoing benefit. However, once the case closes, we still have a claim to collect, and now it's harder to collect from them. We go through an entire process of notifying them, so no one who's currently on AFDC would have it. And to clarify the second part, this would only garnish the PFD of the adult in the household. Even on closed cases, it does not garnish the PFD check of any child.
So then, one final question. I understand there's a $1 million worth of claims outstanding here. Is that correct?
Chairman, our figures for closed cases.
How many? I'm wondering how many cases we're talking about and the amount of money we're talking about.
We're talking approximately about 750 cases in our estimation, and we're talking a figure that could be up to 500,000. But I want to be clear that there's no way that all of that is going to be collectible. We're saying that's how many claims we have. Many of these people have long since left the state of Alaska. They are not even getting claims. But that's the number of closed cases that have claims that we would look to see if this is a mechanism. But the collections would be nowhere near. You'll note from the fiscal note that the collection amounts are small, because that's the number that we think we will make.
So it could be maybe 350 cases, and because you're going to, because some of these people are gone. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Chairman, if I can add there, too, when we contact people, they have an option if they know that we're going, that garnishment of PFD is an option. Some of them may choose to make the payment rather than have it garnished once they know that that is there. And we expect that to happen in some cases.
I'm sorry, on that question there, mm-hmm. You say the last part you just talked about, you do not have garnishment rights now to do that, or... This is what provides you with the garnishment.
Mr. Chairman, that's
ability.
Correct. This provides us. We currently try to collect. We send a letter and say, please pay.
I see. Thank you.
Now we can send a letter and say, please pay, or.
Or.
Could you describe for the committee a typical overcase or overpayment case? How does that happen?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to give a couple, because we're talking about agency and client-caused and not necessarily fraudulent. Some of it's because of the technicalities. We have to sometimes prospectively, in advance, determine how much income a person is going to have and use that against their case. Then later, if their income turned out to be higher than that, we're required then, in the future, to claim even up what that was. Another way it could be is that it would be considered agency error. The client told us that they went to work, and they told us they sent in a paycheck, and the worker didn't call the employer to verify whether there was another paycheck. In fact, there were more earnings than had been reported. Other kinds, particularly in the food stamp program, where we have to count the cost of their rent and whether they have utilities, we may have allowed a deduction for heating expense when, in fact, this person's source of heat was not an allowable one for the heating expense, and so it's very complex. Many of these, particularly in food stamps, are not large errors. Also, a good one example for the AFDC program, and I won't go on, is that the client may call and report that this child has now gone to live with a grandparent and is out of the case. Because of the press of workload, the worker doesn't process that in time for the next, and the client gets a larger grant the next month, even though both the worker and the client attempted, and so we're required to establish the payment claim for that amount, that hundred and some dollars for the extra child. Those are some of the kinds of claims that we have.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. One of the obvious potential criticisms of doing this is to say, well, just clean up your act and don't overpay. Well, that isn't possible because of these kinds of situations. So. Are there any other questions of either the sponsor or Jan Hansen, Representative Norland?
I'm not sure if it's a question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if it's a question for either. I'm just wondering why there's not a section in this bill that talks about the section in law where it talks about where payments may be deducted from PFD, the child support payments, the post-secondary, the list. You say this is going to appear on that list? I'm wondering why there's not a section in the bill that's ordered.
Mr. Chairman, this won't appear in the list. It will, the last part of the list is other agencies that have the authority to do this. And we, this now gives us the authority to fall under that other. And we haven't asked for a particular priority in the listing other than lumped with the other. Part of that is that if we tried to become a priority, it would require additional programming and work on the part of permanent fund dividend, and we wouldn't be able to get the benefit of that this year because they'd have to do something. Whereas if we just come in when it's effective, we can start through the process of notifying clients and then notifying permanent fund dividend division.
Okay, so you don't necessarily have to be on that list to have the authority to do that. I assume otherwise the director would.
The list will take precedence. So.
Yep. For the record, this I'm Marvin Coggins, legislative aide for Representative Toohey, and I think I can clarify that a little bit better. The section that has the list in it then is followed by a section that expands on the student loan collection process, and this would be a new section which followed that section. So it would just be, it would be a separate section.
Okay.
Followed.
Okay. We have also available if. If there are any questions, Michael McGee is here from the Department of Revenue. No further questions? What's the wish of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I move this bill. First of all, I can move this. Do I have to do anything to move this
No, we
okay,
actually have a
me?
Bill that we're not going to mess with.
Okay, so I can just move this bill out of committee with the special recommendations?
And the fiscal notes is attached?
The fiscal notes is attached.
Couldn't we do something to it? I mean, this is
ruining our reputation, yes. Representative Cott.
Just before we do move it out, just since we do have Jan here, or the bill sponsor, is there any reason why this, you may not know it, was not referred to Hess, since every section deals with Department of Health and Social Services? Yeah, I appreciate not getting the opportunity to see it twice. If we can do that and streamline more of those issues, that's great.
I
didn't know right through here. Excuse me. Going ahead. Maybe we do need checks and balances.
No idea.
What you said was Hess.
I think philosophically it doesn't have anything to do with health and social services. It has to do with payments.
Well, I think it's in the health and social services chapter, isn't it?
The content, that's philosophical.
Yeah.
We have a motion to pass with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal notes. Is there objection? Done.
Good. Mr. Chairman, just one thing I wanted to say to Jan before she left. Marvelous presentation you made at Rotary this last week.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Okay. The next bill that we have is H.J.R. 22. Which is a...
Why don't I have that with me? Why don't I have that with me?
Because you are not properly prepared.
I do have it. On the back side, it said H.J. Obviously, they've used another.
We're frugal.
That's right.
We are frugal.
And so I had it upside down. So that's why I didn't know that.
Upside down or backwards?
My staff is more efficient than I give them credit.
Okay, now... What we have is
idiocy. Excuse me.
Larry LeBow.
Larry LeBow.
Mm-hmm. Is he around?
He's not here. He's Representative Foster's aide.
That's true. Bill Swanson.
He's not here.
He's not here. Kay Schofield is here if needed, and it looks like you are.
Yeah, what's this going to cost?
Could we?
Yes, that's already been taken care of.
And they're coming?
I don't know what's happened to them, but I've received their answering machine. So I imagine that they're on the
way. Absolutely, in the wrong direction.
Well, let's give them a shout and make sure.
Oh, yeah.
You already did good. Thanks. Well, why don't we... I'm sorry, is your name Kay or...
Carla.
Carla? Okay.
It worked.
More work.
Well, Carla, come on up here.
I'll put you on the hot seat.
Now, we know you're not the sponsor. We know you're not from elections. You're from our house, but from LAA's perspective, what would the impact of this legislation be?
Mr. Chairman, it would cost money, but the agency is actually neutral on the bill itself. But
sure.
If it passed, we would do what we could to make everything happen.
Is
agency, what, I'm sorry?
Oh, the agency's neutral on the bill. If this passes, then we would do the work that was necessary in order to have additional office space.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Representative Norley?
Thank you. Carl, the fiscal note from LA is about $4 million a year. And I haven't studied the fiscal note, but are you, I mean, this is a physical problem that we exist in trying to fit additional people on the House floor. Are you taking into account that we might have to expand the chambers and what the Senate House? Have you taken
into capital request.
Okay.
We thought we'd put in for a capital request if we had to do that. We'd also need additional space probably during the interim for office space during the interim. Plus, I don't think there's enough room in the Capitol building as it exists to house additional legislators and staff.
Put this off till we move the Capitol.
I see. Mr. Chairman, Representative Nordland made. I noticed under miscellaneous they have indicated that there's potential effect on the legislative lounge, and that also might need to be enlarged. And I would submit that if we keep frequently in that place, it will, whether we add more members to the legislature or not.
Okay, Carla, thank you very much. We actually have the bill sponsor's representative here now, and we'll ask him to come up. Joe, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, any members?
Larry
LeBeau.
Yes.
Aide to Representative Foster. The representative is out of town today and celebrating his fifth wedding anniversary, and I guess that does take precedent over this resolution, at least. The idea behind the resolution, I know we see fiscal notes saying, well, we have to redistrict. Well, we have to redistrict in the year 2000 anyway, and that's really what this whole issue is about, is to try to get people thinking about what are the districts going to look like once we go through a reapportionment in the year 2000, especially if we see the Rail Belt area continue to grow so disproportionate to the rest of the state. And it came home very graphically to us this last time when we saw our district extended another 300 miles down the coast of Alaska. Yeah. So that the total length of our district is something like about 800 miles with no transportation, in essence, from one end of it to the other. The concept is that we should at least be thinking about the impact. We should be thinking particularly not in terms of the number of people you represent, but in terms of the amount of geographic area you have to try to travel over in terms of campaigning and trying to address the needs of such a widely diverse group. There, if you've read the background paper which exists with the packet, it does tell about the efforts of Diamond to increase the size of the original territorial legislature. It also mentions there have been resolutions proposed, at least two resolutions, since we became a state. The issues, I think, as addressed by the paper and by Diamond, are essentially the same ones we're looking at today, and that really is the geographic size of the rural districts. And they have grown substantially because we've seen most of the population move into the Anchorage Bowl area, Kenai, Wasilla area, and Fairbanks, I think maybe to probably a lesser degree maybe than some of the rest of the states have been impacted. The, as I say, purpose, and I'd like to express that, was not necessarily to get a resolution through the legislature this year, but it was to try to find as wide a forum to get as many people, at least in the legislature, thinking about the concept. And ultimately, of course, it would be up to the people on a constitutional amendment if we in fact did change the size of the legislature. We certainly would not recommend or would not support a change taking place until you have to redistrict in the year 2000 anyway following your elections. So that's one of the costs we look at because we have a date on the bill granted. And I know it's concerned how many offices we have and how large the legislative lounge is, but I think this really is more of an issue of how well do the people of the state of Alaska feel represented. And I think ultimately that's where the decision ought to lie. But whichever way it goes, certainly it's up to them, and I think it's their decision. And I'll live with that.
Representative Phillips? James?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd just like to make a comment, and I really appreciate you putting this out here as a consideration, and I understand exactly what the purpose for this is. And I think it is probably timely, except that looks like we're going to have a lot of things on the ballot this next year, and with the with the financial situation we have, I don't think it's a wise idea to have it on the ballot in 94. But I'm thinking that 96 might be a good time to have it on the ballot, and if everybody's thinking about it now, I support that that is a good idea. I am also concerned, Mr. Chairman, and is about the representation that is in the Bush community, because it is must be unwieldy to the point that how can they represent those people? But we do have some possibility of some technology that might be able to speed that process up and might even be cheaper than putting more people in the legislature. But I know that the amount of size of my my chores to do, that we could just share some with some more people. So that's all I have to say.
Then Green, I think, was next. Then Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of quick ones. Now, you said that you had no real anticipation of this doing anything until there was another census, which would become effective, I guess, then in 02, and yet your fiscal note starts in 96. And I guess, was that an oversight or just an attention getter?
I guess the reason that happened is because when the bill was drafted, we really didn't pay much attention to the date on the bill, and they said, of course, it said it would become effective. It was never our intention to try to get this onto the 94 ballot. Representative James hit the nail exactly on the head. It's something that really needs to be thought about seriously. And Representative Foster felt if there was enough interest in the legislature itself to potentially get a resolution through, he's testing the water, basically. What is the response from the legislature? Because quite honestly, if this were an attempt to get it through, this is going to take a full 2 years to get something like this through the legislature, because it certainly could become very controversial.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Followed by follow-up. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, this does have a significant fiscal note, as we heard, for the salaries and that, and then there would be probably a capital fiscal note and interim. I mean, this is maybe just the tip of the iceberg cost-wise, and I'm wondering in the foreseeable future, with declining revenues and if the oil price stays anywhere near where it is now, that this is adding an extremely harsh... it's impacting our revenue stream significantly while we're asking other ports of government to cut. Do you feel that this is consistent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I guess there's nothing sacrosanct about the current organization of the legislature, I guess is the first comment I would have to make. Maybe there's no legislator who could do with less staff. When I first started visiting the legislature, they shared a staff member. So I think the legislative staff has grown as the budget grew, and quite frankly, no, I don't think we're going to be even able to sustain the current when we look at it. I don't think, in all honestly, that we can say that the legislature is exempt from cuts like other sections of the economy or the government.
Okay, thank you.
President Kapp?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the second time that I've seen this measure, and I haven't been convinced that I changed my mind. I voted on it the first time I felt about it. And just to address Representative Green's concern on the financial aspect of it, I try to look at every piece of legislation with an open mind, because really, when you look at it, this has a finance referral, and I think we ought to evaluate legislation in this committee based on the merit of the legislation and try to leave the fiscal ramifications for the subsequent committees if there is a financial committee referral, which there should be if it deals with finances. To kind of, to that point, to Representative James, consideration of perhaps closing the gap between those that represent various communities out in rural Alaska. There is certainly a movement afoot for various technological innovations. One of those innovative ideas is House Bill 405, which will bridge that gap. It's going to be a lot cheaper than adding 5 or 10 more members to the legislature. I only can comment that Don Young seems to do a fairly good job at representing Alaska as a whole. He's one person. Obviously, he must be doing something right. He's been in there for a long time. And I just to address one of your comments earlier on, I think we should at least draw some attention to population. Now, there is, I believe, a Supreme Court case, and maybe Danielle can help me out, I don't remember, where it talks about redistricting and keeping a population, as far as the district size, fairly equal. I don't think there is a Supreme Court case that talks about geography or the distance between communities within a district, or that district should be X amount of miles. And it's a good idea. I understand the concept and some of the problems, I guess, having not campaigned or represented anybody in rural Alaska. Maybe I really don't understand it, but I know there's a sizable problem out there, and maybe what's needed is an increased travel budget for those rural legislators. But I do believe that with technology on the brink of some real unique ideas, that we can bridge the gap between those representatives out in rural Alaska and the constituents that they represent. There'll only be a teleconference away. So with that, I'll yield to the next speaker.
I have to put on my partisan hat and just say, I have to challenge your statement about the effectiveness of Congressman Young representation. Just had to do that. I'm all alone in this room.
To that point, I think the record is clear.
There's some of us may not completely agree with you. But no, my my question was, I wonder, Larry, if there were 45, or what is it, 50 representatives and how many senators? 25 senators. If you tried to look at them under the current population clusters, if you tried to look at a map and see just what the real effect would be, and is it enough effect to really make it worthwhile going through this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nordland, what it does, it would allow the Nana North Slope borough essentially to shrink back to the previous size that it was before it expanded into the Bering Strait region. It would allow the Bering Strait district to shrink back, and in essence would tend to move everybody back, and it would allow for another representative out of the Yupik region of the state, which is one of the areas we've been involved in trying to get a reapportionment agreement. And one of the problems, it's true that reapportionment does speak to population, but it also does speak to identifiable ethnic groups. And I think that's what's been listened to, and that, in fact, I suspect is why we've seen the federal government throw out our two attempts at reapportionment, because we've had suits filed by the various Native groups, the Tanana chiefs, Calista Corporation, because they feel that they're being fractured and that their political impact is being diminished by the increase in size in districts. For instance, I think what right now we represent all or parts of six different school districts in our House district. And I think, matter of fact, I don't know, other than the three single-site districts, we don't have the total of any one of them.
Is that how you came up with that number? Did you look at what number would be the minimum number you could but still achieve some cultural identity or cultural unity within?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nordland, originally we had asked the research be based on 60 and 30, and you'll probably notice those figures when they mm-hmm. speak to it. And beginning to look at population, when we looked at population, decided that we could achieve essentially the same thing by half the expansion.
Mm, good. Also, I wonder if Representative Foster has given any thought to one other major change we could do that would help alleviate some of the costs but would still provide for smaller districts, and that's a unicameral legislature. Has he given some thought to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nordland, we actually had three things prepared all at the same time. One was unicameral legislature. The other was a 100-day session, and we decided that in looking at all three, that this was an awful lot on its own to chew. But I do have the information, and Ledge Research has put together information on unicameral legislature, and that is certainly, I think, could be a consideration. I think that's part of why we're asking for a forum at this point in time. Not that this is necessarily the answer, but let's start thinking about which direction we want to go.
I have Representative Phillips, James, and Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Larry, and for the committee, as one whose district is approximately 15,000 square miles, and during a four-month campaign period puts about 25,000 miles on her car every session, I can certainly relate to the whole issue of the distance and the size. I'm extremely fortunate because I can drive to most of my areas and only have to fly or take a boat to a few areas. I have one question on the makeup of your resolution, on the technicality of the resolution. On the second page, section 29, where you address the whole proposal will apply to the 20th session of the Alaska State Legislature and thereafter. One legislative body cannot encumber another, and I'm wondering if this would fall under the rule that we cannot pass legislation that would affect the future legislator.
Representative Porter, Representative Schultz. In essence, what we would be doing is, I'm not sure that this was simply as a timeline when we would try to implement this. Obviously, when we looked at the fiscal note, this became not at all realistic. Mm-hmm. And we haven't bothered to offer a sponsor's substitute for it because, as I say, it's not our intention to try to get it through the legislature or to expose as many people to the idea as possible. But this would be a constitutional amendment, so in fact, that's how it becomes binding. Because the Constitution does spell out the makeup of the legislature.
It would be constitutional, say, if we were going to proceed with it, putting it on the ballot at some point in time,
probably 96.
94,
no,
96 ballot.
96.
Yeah.
Or even possibly 98.
Yeah. And make it effective in the year 2000, after reapportionment.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative James?
Yeah, I just did a little calculation here just when the question was asked, I believe, by Representative Nordland as to how much difference it would make to add five legislators in. And it's a difference of 2,700 people per representative. When you get out in the urban areas, 2,700 people is a sizable amount of distance that you would be reducing the representation down. So I think it certainly would make a very big difference in the amount, the way that people are represented. I guess that it's, I have to make the comment about all the fiscal note is that if we move the capital, this may not be applicable anyway. So, and that's something we don't know today. We may have a better idea in 96 or even, next time. The other thought that occurred to me in 25 senators is that we would never have an equal distribution, so we would never be in a stalemate like we have 10 and 10 this year.
That may not be a bad idea.
Well, Representative James, we had actually looked at 51 House members for the very reason that you mentioned. But since you have to have equal representation, I couldn't figure out how we were going to divide that other House district up.
A floater.
It's never usually such a problem in the House as it is, and historically it's been a problem.
I think this body is so much smaller.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can commiserate with the concerns since we've heard that some representative candidates have to fly to their constituents and others can drive, and I'm fortunate enough in my district I can actually walk to all my constituents. But I think this geographical difference is a matter of choice, and if a person decides that he wants to run or she wants to run in an area that is remote, as my learned colleague to my left pointed out, we have one federal representative that covers the entire state. So I think the mere fact that the districts are large, in my way of thinking, and now I'll refer to a comment made by my learned colleague to the left that we should confine our comments to judicial and not to economics. I think he's out of line there. This is the third reference to this fiscal note, so I think maybe he's a little... anyway. Are you aware that there is a bill that has been introduced that goes just the opposite, goes to unicameral legislation and reduces the number of senators? In fact, we're down to somewhere in the neighborhood in the 40s total instead of the 60 legislators we have now, which I guess would smack almost in the opposite to every comment that you've made. You said yourself that you had looked at a possibility of a unicameral government. Did you have any numbers in mind when you were thinking that way?
Now, Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, if we had looked at the unicameral, our original idea was looking at 60 members in a unicameral legislature, not in fact changing the size of the body.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions, Larry? Representative Codd?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My comment on the fiscal ramifications should have been taken in such a way that, yes, they should be looked at. However, that should not be your sole purpose for voting down a piece of legislation because of the fiscal aspect. I don't think any of us here understand clearly what the Finance Committee is doing today or what they'll be doing tomorrow. And they may not know either. But
you better figure that out.
Beyond that, my learned colleague to my right made a couple of points, and I just would like to pick up on those. And he did make a very valid point that, when we decided to run for office, nobody pushed us out there with the campaign signs and buttons and whatever else was in front of us. We volunteered, and we knew it up front. As far as my learned colleague to my left making a comment on the Capitol's moved, it may not be an issue. Actually, it may be an issue right now. When the Capitol is moved, and I have no reason to believe that it won't pass, it may not, but I have no reason to believe that, that may be something for them to consider, is that we do have this proposal, this resolution, and in the construction of that facility, depending on how it's constructed, they may allow for that expansion to occur if and when this particular measure ever comes to pass. So just with old comments, I just thought I would air a few of those ideas. And Larry, the last thing, if I might, Mr. Chairman, just my own clarification. With the additional districts, then what we are doing is reducing the size of all the districts by about 2,700.
Mr. Chair, as Representative Cott, yes, that would be correct.
I'd hardly have to leave my neighborhood.
Thank you, Representative Cott.
Thank you.
And Larry, thank you very much. You're going to stand by, I hope. We have Joe Swanson here from Elections. If we could get that perspective, please. Welcome, Joe.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Joe Swanson, Director of Elections. Primarily, I just came because of a request, but we put a fiscal note in because of the reapportionment. If the bill were intended just as a sample of waters, I would have preferred a different date, then we wouldn't have had to go into all the trouble to do a fiscal note. But all we put in this on the fiscal note was the cost of reapportionment. We put a kicker in to say that with every reapportionment the state has gone through, there have been several lawsuits. We only put the cost in of one reapportionment and only for 1 year. And the way reapportionments have happened in Alaska in the past, and I've lived through every one of them, I anticipate that there will probably be three or four reapportionments. And the way this one's going, I think we could just wait until it's finished and include the 25 or 60. The one thing that we did not mention, there would probably be an increased ballot cost. We did not put that in our fiscal note. In that every ballot that we have to, every additional ballot costs $50,000 in every election, so that would be $50,000 for the primary as well as $50,000 for the general, with that many more people running. One comment I would like to make, though, there was some reference to the National Voting Rights Act and justice and preclearance. When they look at a district, or when justice looks at whether or not anybody's rights are hurt, they do not look at the state. They look at each individual district. So if you create more districts, you probably have a bigger chance of somebody filing suit than you currently do. I don't think that will lessen those odds. I think it will increase them. It's not a statewide thing they look at. They look at each district to see if that district or any individual group of people's rights have been hurt by the redistricting. Most of the suits that were filed have been filed, however, in the federal courts and only challenged injustice a couple of times. There's been more just plain suits. Other than that, I don't have any questions of the committee, but glad to answer.
Joe, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming down. Really. Larry, if you would. I'm a little at a loss as to exactly how to proceed. I recognize that this is an issue that's certainly worthy of discussion on a broader spectrum than this, but I don't know if just sending the bill on is going to accomplish that, especially in light of the fact that we're recognizing we're not intending to do it now, and we couldn't put in effective dates to bind other legislatures, and it's kind of a mess. I guess what I'm going to ask is that if you would discuss with Richard exactly what process he'd like to proceed under. And, I mean, it could be that this could be the subject of an interim task force or...
This is what I was writing here.
Oh, look at this, yeah. Yeah. Representative Gray?
Well, I was going to suggest that same thing, and I didn't want to seem self-serving, but I did mention that there is the antithesis of this coming in, and it might be wise to, I'm sure it's going to end up here too, to have them together to put in a study group or review group.
I certainly will discuss it with Representative Foster. This is actually its third committee of referral, so it's gotten a fairly good airing during this particular legislature, at least on the House side. I don't think that finance really has, the last committee of referral in the House would be finance, and I really don't think finance has the time to be taking it up here at this time. And even then, I'm not sure that finance should be the only issue that we're looking at in this case. I think it really is an issue
policy
that goes
change.
Far beyond just the issue of finance. And I suspect that a task force, and so since you're bringing up the unicameral, we had looked at unicameral and decided that we didn't want to trot anything out that looked totally strange to people.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll notice in the historical background, Diamond, in fact, tried to get a unicameral legislature in the 30s, and it was unsuccessful. So I think certainly the whole issue of how people are represented. Matter of fact, I was thinking of that again today on my way down. I was thinking that, you know, it would be so much simpler if we simply took the Senate districts, divided the population equally between them all, and we would certainly, I think, simplify the process. And when you do that, what have you got? You've got a unicameral legislature. But anyway, I'll discuss that with Representative Foster.
Okay. I think there was one other question.
Just a comment in relation to Representative Green's comment. I don't see the unicameral proposal as being the antithesis of this. In fact, the unicameral proposal, from the standpoint of being able to have smaller districts, would achieve what you're trying to achieve. If you had a unicameral legislature with 50 legislators, you would have 50 districts, and you'd have smaller districts.
But if it were 40, you wouldn't have accomplished a thing.
No, you wouldn't have accomplished anything.
That's what I think
the proposal is 49. So there are. So it's, you know, and... But there's a whole different set of issues, of course, whether or not you want to do a unicameral, then to achieve the smaller districts that Representative Foster is trying to achieve. So, but I do think that if there's a task force to study this, that both those should be in the same task force, both those issues.
Well, if you would tell Representative Foster that what we'll do is hold the bill, awaiting his getting back to us on what he'd prefer that we do, and most assuredly under that consideration would be a discussion with the leadership to have an interim task force.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Thank you all for hearing the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything other than that that's on the front of the committee? It's Friday. Have a good weekend.
Good.
Well.
Record.
The later you start, the earlier we get